Welcome back to the Sober Curious podcast with me, Ruby Warrington. This week's episode is with the one and only Holly Whitaker. And I introduce her this way because Holly is a bit of a legend in terms of what is being dubbed the new sobriety. And we're going to hear all about Holly's opinion on whether there is even such a thing as a new sobriety in this episode, as well as all of her thoughts about grey area drinking and the different audiences that she and I are speaking to with our message. Holly is the founder and CEO of online sobriety school Tempest, previously known as Hip Sobriety, and she is an advocate for total abstinence and really on a mission to prove to everybody that alcohol has absolutely no place in our lives. This conversation gets super deep. Holly has tons and tons of research. She's been a leading voice and a pioneer in this movement for many years now. So I'm really thrilled to introduce you to her if you haven't heard of her before, and also to hear your thoughts about some of the topics that we raise in this episode. More from me on the other side. I partnered for this episode with Dry Sparkling, a botanical bubbly that is a perfect non-alcoholic option for celebrations big and small. Just because you're not drinking doesn't mean your social life has to lose its fizz. And Dry was created for sober, curious souls in search of a grown-up alternative to regular synthetic-tasting sodas. Crafted with just four ingredients, Dry's culinary-inspired flavors include vanilla, lavender, ginger, cucumber, blood orange, watermelon, vanilla, Fuji apple, and Reina cherry. Perfect for pairing with food, all Dry sodas are also non-GMO project verified and contain only 45 to 70 calories per serving. You can look for Dry in your local store, shop online at Amazon, and visit drysoda.com for more info about this tasty and sophisticated bev. Holly Whitaker, thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. It's so weird. I never actually do this looking at people in their eyes. I always do it like on Skype or a phone.
I have actually really come to love doing it like this person to person. It actually just feels so much more conversational.
Yeah, I think it's great.
You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, but it's nice just to be with you and to hang out with you. Yeah, we don't get
really
to do this enough.
You too. Yeah, I haven't seen your new apartment. It's beautiful.
Thank you. And yeah, as I was saying before we got on the mic, you have been so incredibly busy, I feel like, well, ever since I first encountered your work, but it's kind of like ramped up over the past 6 months, year. I suppose.
Yeah.
You are finishing up your book, which is awesome, which maybe we can chat a little bit about that
later. Sure,
You also launched the Temper about, what, 6 months
October,
ago? October, which is, how do you describe the Temper?
The Temper is, I would say, at the intersection of identities and the intersection of sobriety. And so what we really mean to be is like an inclusive publication that specifically focuses on life lived without alcohol, right? Life lived either in recovery and sobriety. We tackle a number of different addictions, and we also try very hard to represent a lot of different identities, experiences, so that people can find themselves in other people's stories, and also just these like really interesting narratives that that people can thread through, like coming out as non-binary after coming out sober, and how those two things are connected, and just stuff that's not typically explored in sobriety.
And it is very, very cool. And it serves as an editorial platform that supports your sobriety school, which many people may have been familiar with as Hip Sobriety, but you rebranded and relaunched, I think, just like last week or two weeks ago. So this is why you've been busy. Relaunched 2 weeks ago as Tempest. And I wanted to get into kind of what Tempest is and why you felt there was such a need for it.
Yeah.
But before that, I want to talk a bit about how we met and kind of like, and you even just brought it up right now, right? Before we got on the recording,
we're
both kind of speaking to a similar space and yet we're not.
Yeah.
We're speaking to different groups within this kind of like homogenized space, I suppose, of what gets called or what got called in the New York Times this weekend as the new sobriety.
Right.
It's not as simple as just the new sobriety. There are many conversations kind of happening behind the scenes and interwoven within that. And I think it'll be great if we can get into some of the differences about like who you are speaking to and
who I'm speaking to with Sober Curious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because on the surface, they can get lumped together as the same thing.
Yeah.
And they're kind of not.
They kind of aren't, and they kind of are. I think they're both it's spectrum, right? Mm. It's like not two different things. It's a spectrum of experiences, right? Mm-hmm. So
when we first met, and I'm going to tell this story to have it on the record.
We've talked about it on a panel before.
We spoke about it on a panel. Yeah. But it really was such a kind of like pivotal moment for me in terms of what I'm doing with Sober Curious. And I'm grateful to you for that.
Yeah.
And I think it's also a really good example of how we can learn from conflict as well. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So a few years ago, it was in the end of 2016, actually, and I mentioned this on my How to Party Sober episode a couple of weeks ago. I was well into my sober curiosity, and I was hosting my Club Soda NYC events by this point, and found myself at the Austin City Limits Festival in Texas on the first day of a month-long road trip. My favorite band, LCD Sound System, happened to be playing. It was all kind of quite kismet because they had previously announced they weren't going to be doing any more shows. So, you know, the cosmos was aligned for a night of revelry in a field listening to music. And that had always been for so long. Like, of all of the kind of drinking occasions, that had been the one that I'd, like, I don't want to use the word clung on to, but the one that I had still been like, you know, that's when potentially for me a beer or two feels like an appropriate substance or something I might do. So I had a couple of beers that night, and I posted something about it on Instagram the next day.
Yeah.
And Holly, we hadn't met in person at that point. I'd been following you or I've been aware of Hip Sobriety. Yeah. And you were like, dude, that's not cool.
Yeah.
You can't be talking about hashtag high sobriety and then go out and have a couple of beers and make out like it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, I'm a massive conflict avoider, so I was quite gut punched. But at the same time, I was like, fuck, she's right.
Yeah.
If I'm going to put my head above the parapet and have it and even speak on this, I need to define what it means to be sober curious. And I need to actually acknowledge the responsibility that comes with talking about this extremely nuanced subject that for many people is a life and death situation.
Yeah.
So I'm going to officially thank you now, Holly, for that call out. But for me, it's part of this. We live in this call out culture, right? Where we cancel culture, not even call out. Yeah, right. Where we all have the potential to have a platform and to have a voice.
Yeah.
And with that comes a responsibility to really consider, like, what am I putting into the public consciousness? Like, what am I putting into the arena? What am I bringing up? And how am I going to back that up with my actions? How am I going to be in integrity? So it was the first time following that I actually wrote about what it meant to me to be sober curious. And so in a way, it kind of set me on the path to doing what I now do, having created a whole platform around this. So then when you, a year or so after that, reached out of the blue and were like, I'm going to be in New York, let's have dinner. At first, I was like, wow, so honored that this, like, super smart. Well, yeah, I was like, wow, she's so smart. She's such a leader in this space and a pioneer in this space. She wants to have dinner with me. That's so cool. And shit, I'm so afraid because I thought you were going to be, I thought you wanted to meet up with me and be like, you can't do what you're doing. But you didn't.
No, I wanted to get to know you better and work with you.
You wanted to get to know me better, exactly. Mm-hmm. And see, I guess, where there were crossovers, parallels, or at least get into a communication and a dialogue about, look, we're in this space.
Yeah.
It's an exciting place to be. How can we support each other?
Yeah. And that's what we did.
And that's what we have been doing. Yeah.
I think it's so interesting. There's a couple things on this that I like. You know, one of the things that I think we don't really allow for ourselves and for each other is there's so many points that I want to dive into. But like the first is that there is, you know, you don't go from being you don't skip being a toddler and then go right into adolescence. Like, you actually have to be a toddler to get into adolescence. And the same goes for us for the rest of our lives. Like, we have to really truly be able to evolve through experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think, and I'm saying this specifically about myself and also about that experience that you had, I unfollowed you after that. And then I was like done. And I had this intolerance for someone that, you know, was in a place that, you know, I was rejecting because because I had, you know, evolved past this, or I had this idea that, you know, I had the right answer. And I think it's really interesting because one of the things that this, I think the healing that we so speak of when it comes to this awareness around drinking and this just awareness around the places that we're hurt and the places we need to heal, like this is about allowing ourselves to be where we're at so that we can continue, and also to appreciate the stages we've been before, because there's no getting, you know, further in our evolution, further in our healing, further in our understanding of ourselves, the world, without like actually having been through the places where we didn't know what we mm-hmm. didn't know. Mm-hmm. And we have, I think, the cancel culture, call out culture, or whatever you want to call it, like it just limits this ability to let people make mistakes and to let people learn and to ask questions. It's just, it's so divisive. And so I think, you know, when I hear that story, I think of that and I'm like, you know, I've learned a lot of lessons, I think, being on social media and having such a meaty subject matter and such a like personal subject matter and a subject matter that has so much stigmatization and history attached to it. So I think that's the first, which is I would never do that. You know, I think I would probably DM you and like say, hey, we should talk about this. But the other part of it, then there's this other part of it too, which is the populations that I typically work with. They're anybody from people that struggle with like just trying to not drink, you know, binge drink every other weekend, to people that are drinking, you know, every night, like one glass, two glass, that are just afraid of what's happening to them, to people that, you know, are severe in spectrum addiction. And I think that when you are dealing with this, most like people want to, like, we just want the third door. When we're talking about like recovery, we're consistently looking to we're consistently looking for ways to keep all like the best of all worlds, to not have to make the change, to not have to do the uncomfortable work. And so when I work with people, and this is like, this happened with Kelly Brogan, who was on our podcast for about sobriety years ago, and who was like, oh, like who doesn't take ibuprofen, but like still, you know, drinks red wine. And then, you know, took a conversation she and I had after that and turned it into a blog post about why drinking wine is ceremonial and it's okay, but don't drink tap water. It was just like, there is a number of people that will die looking for that way to keep something in their lives that is not working for them. Mm. And so I think that there is, for me, it always comes down to this like social responsibility. I think that always comes down to kind of minding this, like, when we're talking about sobriety, that's a word that specifically goes to what people achieve when they are able to go through recovery and abstain from a substance that they are addicted to. Like, it is not, sobriety is not, you know, I'm not sober from cocaine because I really never used cocaine, I am, like, when I think of sobriety, the time that it came into play for me was when I stopped drinking, because I almost died from drinking, as I almost died from eating disorders. So I'm in recovery from eating disorders, as I was a huge fucking pothead. So I'm in recovery from drug addiction. And so I'm not like, these aren't terms I use to define every single day of my life. I don't walk outside and go like, I'm in recovery today. I barely even think about it. I have a life that's very full and it's like lived with intention and all this stuff. But I think when it comes back to it, you know, like the New York Times article, it is this like co-opting of something that like people is a badge of honor for people that like is something they can claim. And then on the other side of it, like sobriety has also been used as this weapon against people because of the history of the recovery like industry. It's like, you're either sober or you're a fuck up. You're either sober or you're relapsing and you lose it all. Your only worth is attained through days. Like, it's something you have to count. And so I think that like when we say something that's like sober, curious, but then like Jen Batchelor's still like, I drink once a month, but like, and is like the face of something that is now like this aspirational wellness movement, like versus like I'm sober because I lost my kids, and I'm sober because I like, because my life is falling apart. These are two very different worlds. And I think it's not a matter of you don't get to use this word. Only we get to use this word. I also don't think it's a matter of like, there's, you know, sobriety only looks like this one thing. I think it's a matter of respect. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a matter of like holding the like lineage of where it comes from, who fought for it, mm-hmm. who made it, like, you know, it like, Sober Curious didn't come from a bunch of people that just thought it'd be cool not to drink. It came from people that started speaking out about their sobriety and actually sharing their stories and opening up what their very personal and gross parts came, like the people that spoke about it at first are people that had so much to lose for doing it. And then I think like, then it just like everything in our society, it just gets like broken down like a potato chip. It just gets boiled down to like the fried delicious part of it, and like all of the substance just falls out. You know, in that article, it's just like, it was shocking that there's like at the very end one story of one woman who's in recovery, but most of it was trying to show this picture of you can be sober and you can still drink. That was the subhead.
This is I know. And so for anyone who isn't familiar, it literally just came out this weekend, which is why it's something we're talking about. If you're listening to this podcast, if you're listening to this podcast in 5 years' time, we're recording the weekend of June 16th, 2019, and the New York Times did a big piece titled "The New Sobriety," and it's not the new
in the style sobriety. Section.
In the style section.
Well, the thing
is as well, I mean, we can't ignore the fact that like because more people are getting comfortable about talking about not drinking, whether they are sober or sober curious or just choosing not to drink for whatever other reason.
Yeah.
An industry is developing around that, of course.
Sure.
And you're part of it.
As it does. Yeah.
You know,
it's well, I'm part of like, I would say like, we're part of it, but we're also like not an industry that's built around the new sobriety or like sober curiosity. I mean, we help people stop drinking. Mm-hmm. Like 97% of the people that come through a program at this point qualify for spectrum, like for alcohol use disorder. So we offer solutions to people to help them quit drinking. We're not like profiting off of sobriety, right? Like I think that's a big distinction.
That is a big distinction, and thank you for making it. And you know, that is the nature of the new, I mean, I used to work in fashion magazines as well. It's like where there are glossy products, they will get packed. Where there is a need, there will be glossy products that come in to kind of meet that need, and that will be packaged and written up as a trend. That's just kind of like how that style of media works. And what you're doing and what I've been doing with the Numinous and what I've been doing with my own personal Sober Curious platform with my book is creating a different kind of approach to media, even a different way of telling those stories, you know?
Well, it's lowering the bar so that people can look at their relationship with alcohol. I mean, that's the point of it, is to be able to give people the ability to consider how alcohol is showing up in their lives or how anything is showing up in their lives, to like present this room for awareness. And I think it's something I've been talking about all weekend with my friends. And I think it's just one of these things that like it gets picked up into like in a capitalist society, it gets picked up and repackaged and sold. And that's just what it is. And I think it's just like, my friend and I were talking this morning. We're like, we knew this would happen. We knew, of course, this like narrative would come out from it. It's silly for me to defend and say I'm not part of this. Like, we have a consumer brand. We specifically went out to try and lower the barrier for people to be able to consider how alcohol showed up in their lives and to make people, I mean, the point of why I started Hip Sobriety, the point of why I started my Instagram was to like shine a light on it and create social proof and show people that like they could be sober too. They could like actually like claim their pain and all the stuff that's typically been stuffed in a basement. And so it was like really to break the shame and the stigma around it. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just like, it is to me, like the thing of it was like, of course, like we get sick because we live in this capitalist, like consumerist, like image driven, like society. Like that's what makes us sick, is that we're totally stripped of any meaning and we're sold what's supposed to like have meaning.
We're all miserable. We're broken. We're basically raised to believe that we're broken from like word go.
That's right.
The only way we can fix ourselves is by consuming this thing.
Buying these face products or Botox or Lululemon. It's just like, it never fucking ends. And so... But that's why we're sick. That's why we turn outside of ourselves, because we weren't meant to live this way. We weren't meant to live in a society that robs us of our connection to each other and to what matters, and to chase all of this materialistic stuff. And so I think it was just, I was just like settling in on the irony that so much of what I think about is how free market societies and capitalism, and you can see this when you like look at low to middle income countries like that are just like developing capitalist infrastructures and the introduction of alcohol in those societies, and you just see this explosion of addiction, and like you just see like capitalism begets addiction, and so it's, to me it's so ironic that this article was just like, you know, barfing like sobriety as like as a byproduct of capitalism, and without even like going to the roots of it and doing to that, like the movement that like we were claiming to heal us and using it as the same thing. That's a, like another tool to oppress us. And so it was just like so much like wrapped. It was like an enigma wrapped in a,
it just, it kind of, it this is what I, when I said this is a very multi-nuanced subject, this is kind of what I'm talking about. Can you unpack a little bit more about what you just said? Capitalism begets addiction. 'Cause that's something I talk about in my book as well. And something I'm definitely actively engaged in.
Yeah.
Helping to dismantle in whatever ways that I can.
Sure. So when you look at like specifically, there's a really good resource on this is Bruce Alexander's The Globalization of Addiction. And he is the Rat Park guy.
Like, oh, yeah. Okay. So for people that are unfamiliar with the Rat Park guy, you could just Google that and find him. But he essentially created this experiment that showed that rats, when given cocaine, they're given a choice between like being alone with cocaine or being in a rat park with loads of fun amusements and other rats to connect with, and no cocaine.
Yeah.
And they will choose the rat park because what they really want is connection, and what they're really craving and what really fills the void that you could also say we're all born with because of our separation from the universal oneness. Yeah. They will choose the connection. They will choose the fun. They will choose the rat park.
Yeah. Well, they won't, when they're in rat park, they don't use drugs. Like when they're around their rat friends in a hospital environment and they're not in wire cages, they will be given like the choice to use drugs or not use drugs. Right. And even if they come in addicted, they'll choose not drugs. Like, and so if they are in the wire cages, they'll choose the drugs. Mm. And so it's just this like this. So the man that was behind that wrote this incredible book, and it's called Globalization of Addiction. And it's about, you know, simply just like tracing back the emergence of free market societies and how they work and how it displaces people, like people's belonging, their sense of meaning and contribution. It turns, you know, humans into human resources, and essentially like strips us, you know, moves into cultures and just rips out culture and basically implants like the machine, the profit motive machine. And so in individuals in societies like this, like, you know, like a prime example that he uses is Vancouver, British Columbia, and how it was settled really like in the late 1800s, and we moved in, and we white people, but the white man moved in and basically obliterated the native community, and then it became a city of industry. And because of that, there's these, like, because it happened so quickly and so totally, and because all these different cultures were thrown into this, you know, very like machinist like society that was only about capitalism, like only about production, the rates of addiction, because there was no connection, was just, it surged. And so the point is that like whenever we are ripped from like our like feeling like we can contribute to society, we can belong in society, we're safe in society, we're connected to each other, the more we lose that, you know, this is like Johann Hari, the opposite of addiction is connection. Mm-hmm. Like the more we lose this intimacy and this connection, the more we have to turn to some like alternative in order to feed that. And so which is drugs and alcohol and gambling and all sorts of behavioral and substance addictions. It's not just alcohol. Alcohol and drugs tend to like get the like, you know, the like they're the ones that we pay attention to. We typically call addiction, but there's, social media. I mean, like there's so many different ways that we turn outside of ourselves. So that's what I mean by that, which is just, it is when we are like chasing a meaning, like when we're chasing something that is devoid of any meaning And we don't feel like we fit in, and we don't feel like we can express our true gifts, and we like feel like the only point is to make money and to like keep the machine going.
Achieve more high and hard.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're separated from our, like, we move away from our family. Like, there's just this, like, we're just robbed of all the things that make us human, and we turn into, like, you know, inhuman, and then. You know, and there's a million things you can go in to talk about this, the ways that we, like, break down humans. But the point of it is just that when people are, like, when they're stripped of this, they, like, of course, turn to manage that pain with something, anything. And so...
Well, so much of it, when it comes to alcohol, I think it's just been... It's universally fed to us as something that facilitates connection. That's the most kind of like saddest irony of all is that we think we're going to find our way into Rat Park only by consuming alcohol.
Yeah. You know, it's true. Because and like that
Park,
intimacy.
The Rat Park that capitalism has created is awash with alcohol. Like alcohol is sometimes a price of entry into our capitalist Rat Park.
Yeah.
Meaning, you know, bars, restaurants, any ways to socialize, any ways to connect.
Yeah, and it's a really white thing, too. Like, it is, like, alcohol kills 3.3 million people a year. All illicit drugs worldwide combined kill 500,000. Mm. So alcohol is also, like, because it's typically a puritanical white drug, it's also replaced all other ceremonial drug use around the world because of the war on drugs. Not to, like, go too off subject, but it is, like, it's basically, like, every single, like, peyote or ganja, every single drug use across the world has been, like, made illicit and policed by the American war on drugs, and then alcohol is replaced as the legal alternative. So it's also just...
Alcohol being the one that numbs us down the most, rather than that could be seen as a suppressive experience of transcendence.
Yeah.
Meaning escapism, suppressive escapism, meaning we get the escapism, we get the transcendence that we're craving, that we actually need, I believe, through suppressing what hurts and what feels painful, versus many of the other substances that you just mentioned, which can be evocative ways of experiencing that. It can take us deeper into our emotional experience, potentially deeper into our pain, but ultimately can be a healing experience.
Yeah, well, like psychedelics are all rage now. And
exactly.
There was something, too, that I thought was really interesting. You mentioned... There's a new book. Have you read Never Enough?
No.
Oh, God. Then it's by Judith. I want to say it's Judith Griswold, but that sounds like something from, like, Christmas
National
Vacation.
Christmas Vacation. It is. But there are other people out there named Griswold.
I don't know.
I think it's quite a common name.
Is it? It may be. Okay, so maybe her name is Judith Griswold. I'm not sure. But she says, I find it so fascinating that we celebrate peak experiences with a depressant.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Like, and I think of that when you said I had this perfect moment and then I had, and then I took a drug to dull that moment.
Mm-hmm. And I've now become so much more educated and so much more sensitized.
Sure.
Isn't that interesting? Why would I do that? It's very interesting. Yeah. But I talk about this in my book as well. I think it's because we're trained to believe that we can't feel that good.
That's right. So we
feeling
like, bring
good is
it
not
down.
Available to us.
Yeah.
And I was really curious when I first really started going longer and longer periods of abstinence that my cravings for alcohol would actually really kick in anytime I was feeling naturally high, anytime I was feeling like a natural sense of relief or relaxation, anytime I felt like I had a ton of energy and was really excited, I would start craving alcohol. And I was like, fuck, that's because it feels
your body,
very destabilizing.
Right. Your body can't handle it.
it's so unfamiliar to me to be feeling high and to be feeling expressive.
That's right.
My instinct was to kind of dumb that down bring me back down to the level of everyone else around me, basically, which is kind of perennially stressed, pretty pissed or scared about life.
Yeah.
Understandably, because there's a lot of things to be pissed and scared about.
Did you, have you ever read, like, The Big Leap by Gay Hendricks?
Yes.
Is that where you got it from? Okay.
Multiple times. No.
I think, the threshold of feeling good,
right?
Like,
yes,
we don't have that, like, capacity to feel really good as soon as it does. That's typically when we tank it the other way.
And I have that experience repeatedly now as a non-drinker, but I'm very cognizant of it happening now.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, there's a low is going to come. So when that low comes, I can be like, what are you here to teach me, low? What are you here to show
That's
me?
Right.
What do I need to change, low?
Yeah.
Well, anxiety, what are you here to, like, what are you here to get me to put the brakes on so I don't go further down this anxiety train, you know?
Yeah.
I'm really learning from learning all of the feelings.
Like how to manage the edges of your energy, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's a really great way.
Or relax. Pema Chodron says, learning how to relax into the edges of your energy.
Oof.
Like, because I'm so edgy, you know? I have so much, like, in me, and it hurts. And so, I get that.
The edges, man, they hurt.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit. I was looking at, you know, you recently did, you just launched Tempest, which mm-hmm. is awesome. And I was kind of reading your, like, you know, why I do what I do story.
Yeah.
And you talk about your sobriety story in there. Yeah. And you also just say that AA was not an option for you. It was a non-starter. And then you kind of like swiftly move on to talking yeah. about what yeah. you do. And I'm wondering if you could just dive a bit more into that, because I think sure. this is something I've experienced a lot since my book came out and since talking about being sober curious. Many people have come forward and said thank you, because AA really didn't resonate with me.
Yeah.
And I would love, but then equally I've had people who have got sober curious, found their way to AA as a result sure. of actually beginning to question and yeah. been like, thank fuck, this is exactly what I needed.
That's right.
And I think my sort of point being is AA is great and it's not for everybody.
Yeah, it's just like anything.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'd love to just speak to me a bit about your experience with it and how that led to you wanting to create what was then Hip Sobriety and what sure. is now Tempest.
Sure. And I think like a lot of this is like part of my book, and so I'm not going to get into a ton of it.
Yeah, cool.
But for me, it's so funny that everyone wants to know, well, what do you mean it wasn't? I mean, we can't even just say it just wasn't. It's like, there's gotta be more to it. It had to have like been this or that. And it's because we have this very old history of thinking that it's the one way and the only way. And I don't like when you dig into AA or like start really like digging into the history of like either, you know, Bill Wilson, who I now, having researched him, have a profound love and respect for, like such a revolutionary. And also,
I'm just going to interject very quickly. I looked up his birth chart the other day.
What is he?
Sagittarius.
Is he born on my,
Sagittarius, which is like super expansive, very kind of forward thinking and yeah. kind of a big risk taker as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he has a Pisces moon.
Oh, really?
A Pisces moon is possibly the most emotionally sensitive and empathetic yeah, of all placements in astrology.
Yeah.
And my highly psychic friend. Of course. But no, it's so interesting because Pisces moon, I have a friend who's psychic and, you know, an intuitive kind of life coach. And she's always said the one piece of advice for anyone with a Pisces moon: stay well clear of anything addictive. Because there's such hypersensitivity yeah. to energy and to emotions.
That's right.
that's just like you're constantly walking around absorbing mm-hmm. everyone's energy,
yeah.
unable to differentiate what's mine, what's yours. And so this huge, what feels like an actual need mm-hmm. to transcend that and go to another place. So just, sorry to interject.
No, that's great.
Bill, I feel an affection for Bill too. After learning yeah. about his Pisces moon, I'm like, yeah. fuck, yeah, he really felt like he needed that.
And he was a total revolutionary. And
yes.
he created something that didn't exist, and he took care of people, and he also warned against dogma and all sorts of stuff. And he was not lost in this idea that this is the one way and the only way. And I don't think a lot of people from the early days of AA and their intentions were ever to say that this is it. But we've grown into this is it. And so when you, because there's nothing else, and like there's Women for Sobriety and Rational Recovery and Refuge Recovery, it's still at the end of the day, people still think in terms of AA. And I think like for me, and I'll get into it in the book, it wasn't mm-hmm. right for me. Mm-hmm. That's it. It mm-hmm. just was nothing about it felt like, and I tried it. I did, you know, I went to a number of meetings and I called myself an alcoholic for a period of time and it just, no. So,
okay.
I mean, that's about as far as I want to get into
that's
it.
Cool.
But I, you know, for me...
And I think a lot of people will be able to resonate with
yeah.
that, you know?
Well, I mean, it's like, again, I just wrote a whole book on it. So
yes.
I'd rather, like, you know, have you buy the book.
Which is out, I think, in December.
It's December 31st, 2019.
Okay, okay. Cool.
Yeah. God willing.
Heads up.
Yes. So I think there is, you know, I started this because I worked in healthcare and because I didn't miss a day of work. I was in the middle of a huge project. I delivered it on time and under budget, and I did all the things I was supposed to do. And I got sober in this period of time, and I was successful in my sobriety. I was very happy. I was very in love with it. It didn't feel like I, you know, as somebody who had never been able to quit biting her nails, stop eating meat, you know, like stick to a diet, quit smoking cigarettes. I had never been able to quit anything, and I quit alcohol, and then I got over my eating disorder, and then I got over cigarette and pot addiction, and then, like, you know, and just it like went on and on and on, and so quickly and so effectively. And so for me,
just through finding your own tools,
for kind of like researching the fuck out of it, yeah, and trying everything and, yeah, giving myself over to it, I knew, yeah, when I started this I wanted to create something more. Like, I was on a call with one of, like, a woman I was in a coaching program with, Ashley Burnett, like, probably, I don't even know when, like, maybe like early 2013, before I'd even quit. And I just remember I was drunk and stoned and, like, talking to her, and, like, her husband was sober, and so I wanted to talk to him. And I just remember, like, saying, like, this is where something needs to be built. And I went on, you know, I was, like, not even, like, I guess in July, like, the end of June 2013, just a few months sober, I was, like, writing out what my website was going to look like, and I have a wireframe from that. I knew I wanted to create something that was not there for me. When I first looked up, what the fuck do you do when you're sober for fun? There was an article on, oh my God, what was that guy's name? Bucky Sinister. Like, do you know who that is?
Is that really his real name?
Yeah, he was like this, like, legendary San Francisco something.
No, and I've never heard of him.
He had this cool old name. WordPress blog, and he was like, you go to a meeting, you get, like, I have a VCR. I go, like, I need to find that article. It still exists. But it was basically, he went to the VHS store and he rented VHSs and he watched a lot of VHSs and he went to meetings. And I was like, fuck me, you know?
Like,
and so, I mean, and there was also, I was the only person that didn't do AA. And I mean, there was, you know, this is not that long ago, but it was, you know, eons ago in terms of what was available to, what was available. And so I think it was just it was seeing like this thing that I needed, and having, and working in healthcare, and having nobody, and me talking to the doctors I work with and teaching them how to talk to their patients about it. And it just was like, you've got to be kidding me,
yeah,
that this is a state of addiction. And I was working at a conference, Health 2.0, and I was working at a health tech conference. And I just remember I begged them to talk about addiction, and this is 2014, and there was no product on the market that addressed it. Like, that, this is like the cutting edge of what's happening in healthcare.
Yeah,
in 2014,
right,
there was nothing on the fucking market
besides
about addiction.
Super expensive rehabs, like.
No, I'm talking about, like, the cutting edge of it. It's called it was a conference called Health 2.0, and it's where all the new stuff. It's like where the health industry is like and taking, you know, venture capitalist dollars, and they're creating all of these new, like, biometrics, or like you know, like, personalized medicine, like, there's just, like, anything and everything, like, and, like, that's, like, that needs to be done in healthcare. You know, this is where you go. Mental health was, like, starting to, you know, kind of, like, tick up. There was a thing called Lantern that was being introduced. There's all sorts of stuff, but substance abuse didn't get brought up once at all. And, like, it was just this, like, I don't know. It was like, just, are you kidding? Like, yeah, everywhere I went, it was like, how is this one thing that hurts so many people so absolutely receiving, like, the least amount of
and
attention?
And at least to so many other health problems.
Yeah.
Like, that's actually at the root of so many other diseases.
Or we'll
mental,
stand in the
physical,
way.
Yeah.
Right. Or we'll stand in the way from recovering from other issues. Like, if you're diabetic and you have drink, you know, it just goes. Anyway, so it was, I think, like, there was, I had this experience, and this very acute personal experience, and this very specific point of view, and that was mixed with a professional experience and an ability to, like, you know, basically, like, there was an opening for something between personal experience, like, vision, and then just, you know, knowledge. And so I started Hip Sobriety in 2014, and it was a blog that really meant to, like, you know, speak about, like, how wonderful it is to not drink, and that sobriety could be rewarding, and that, you know, maybe we don't have to call ourselves alcoholics. And maybe, you know, it started as a way to talk differently about addiction and to talk differently about sobriety and recovery. And then it really blossomed into, I figured out what had worked for me and why it had been so effective. And that was what I codified, turned into a sobriety school. That I ran in 2015 with 13 people that now thousands of people have been through and is what Tempest primarily does. We have an aftercare program too, but it primarily is it built off of that. I wanted to figure out what worked for me and then make a template of it so that I could give it to anybody. So that, you know, mostly women and any like historically oppressed person, because, you know, AA was built for white dudes. Mm-hmm. I wanted to create something. I created something that was built around a very different archetype that needed, you know, not the breaking down of an ego and such.
And more holistic.
Approach. And that's absolutely holistic, right? Yeah. AA is community and spirituality, and, you know, there's SMART recovery, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, and we deal with like the entire, like all of you matters, and all of you come whole, you already come whole, and we work with the whole you. And it's just, again, it's meant to like really build people up and really like, you know, ego is this thing that's consistently seen as like getting over your ego. And in this, we just recognize that like, you know, a woman's ego is probably much different than a dude, that, you know, a man's ego. And that one is, you know, the sense of self of a woman is a lot more destroyed and needs to be built up. And so while I can say, I understand like through like A Course in Miracles or like any of like my, you know, yogic work or Buddhist work, I can understand my ego and how I have to like work with that, you know, and I, within the context of what we do, it's all about being able to give, you know, to build people up and have something like that even exists to start working with a sense of power.
So a stronger sense of self, if that's kind of what
stronger sense
of
self
about our ego.
Exactly. I mean, like ego isn't bad. Like you need to have one to be able to operate in this world. Most of us have just been, you know, we come in humble and on our knees and asking for, you know, for everyone to forgive us. And, like that's where we start. And so, which is what, you know, like programs like AA typically beg, you know, apologize, identify your character flaws, get rid of them, be more perfect. And that's not like, I am, you know, like saying this like pretty strongly, like, but that is not the exact words, but that is what happens. That is how it ends up getting wielded against women in general, which is just be more humble. I like since
well,
being
be
on this
perfect.
Path,
anything that's be more perfect. And I think you said this, you know, and you, I'd sort of read through something you were saying on the site for Tempest about, you know, the way that we think about the way that relapse and the way that day counting kind of actually the idea of a relapse being again,
go back to day
fucked
one,
up, go back to day one.
You lose it's all like, of this.
It's just, it's cultivating this idea of perfectionism, which is what drives so many people to drinking in the first place, myself included.
Yeah. That's right. And you can't, right. And then you also like, what's the point of it if you keep losing it and you can't break out of this cycle? I get asked the most, how do you break out of the cycle? And you break out of the cycle by like actually changing the way the cycle moves, right? Like, so it's not that you drink, it's that you can, in the moment where you feel the worst about yourself, you can inject love and compassion and that you get to try again and that you're worthy of trying again. And that you haven't actually
learned
lost
so
your
much
worth.
Already, right. And that you're doing so good
right.
already.
Yeah.
Right.
And that it's not built on this path of like perfection, it's built on this path of experience. So
let's talk a bit more about the word alcoholic. You sort of touched on it there. And I know that for many people who are describing themselves or thinking, well, maybe I'm sober curious, also don't identify with the word alcoholic.
Yeah.
And I think it's a word you have problems with. And I'd like if you could just tell me a bit about that. Because also it's like, and this is something that we've kind of I think we sort of discussed it slightly on the panel that we did in January. It's kind of like, how can your movement, how can what I'm doing speak to to all people who are at all different points on this spectrum, right?
Yeah.
And I think for me, part of being very openly sober curious and speaking to a lot more people about their experience, their individual experiences of drinking and using other drugs as well, it's helped me to have so much more compassion and understanding for people at all different levels of addiction, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I can see very clearly now that I was not an alcoholic. Like I never thought I was an alcoholic. And now I kind of know because, well, I can say, yeah, I know my drinking was very different. My experience is very different from people who do identify with the word alcoholic. And it's given me so much more compassion for people like, fuck, yeah, that's hardcore. And I understand why a different approach is needed for people who are drinking that way. And I guess I'm curious, as well as your thoughts on the word alcoholic, to hear what you have to say about if alcoholism is a self-diagnosed disease. And this must be something, and again, your face is
no.
Like, what?
No. No, it's just...
that's something that is spoken of. And what I'm getting to is like, yeah, let's just... I'd love to hear your thoughts on at what point does drinking become... have to stop drinking?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's just like, again, like there is... Yeah, there's so much to this. The first is... I don't think that alcoholism is a thing. I think it's like a label that we forced on a number of people who have been willing to accept it. And again, this isn't to take this away from people that find it absolutely useful. It's to basically say, instead of looking at the problem of alcohol in general, which is a drug, which is an incredibly toxic drug that is responsible for, again, killing 3.3 million people worldwide.
And extremely addictive, as far as drugs go, even.
Extremely addictive. And it's also, I mean, that's half of how many people die of, you know, of cigarette smoke. And it's going to it's gonna shift out. It's going to totally surpass that at a certain point. I mean, the multinational alcohol conglomerates are only growing. It'll get worse. So we'll see that surpass tobacco. So I think it's like saying like we have really gone down this path. There's an etiology here of like how this happened, but you know, essentially it went from the problem of alcohol to trying to find what's wrong with these sick fucks with like a genetic predisposition to alcoholism. That's a total like that is a man-made idea to deflect. To deflect from alcohol as a problem to people as a problem. And so
alcohol, which is very highly profitable for many.
A $1.6 trillion dollar industry. Yes. But also it is a way for, it is like, there is, I mean, that's just specific. That's just like, there's so many different things that can be said about it. And again, my book, goes into this at great length, but this is also just basically saying, there is no cigarette-aholic, no cocaine-aholic, no heroin-aholic. There's no drug that we're like, it's okay for these people to use, but not those people to use. It's just not good to use cocaine. It's just not good to smoke cigarettes. It's just not good to, you know, like, shoot a heroin. Right. So it's like, it's just saying that there is... We're trying to find this distinction. You know, you want me to, I don't know. It's like nobody should be drinking this shit. And some people can get away with it, just like some people can smoke a few cigarettes. And some people, can cross over into addiction. And some of those people, like you have said, it never gutted you the way that it gutted me. It didn't do to you what it did to me. But who fucking knows who knows what, was possible for
you? Had I not got sober curious when I did, possibly would have.
Yeah, that's right. And so it's to say, to me, anybody that has a problem with alcohol is just somebody that doesn't like how it's showing up in their lives. That's it. And it's like, it has to go back to the individual. It has to stop being this like specific scale, the specific number, the specific like NCAD, which is AA is who is responsible for putting out the 26-point questionnaire on whether or not you're an alcoholic.
Right.
Now, all this stuff, when you trace it all back down, when you go back to the beginning, you start to see, that makes sense. There's an interest there. There's an interest there. There's an interest there. And again, this doesn't take away from the fact that there is severe progressive alcohol addiction. Some people are more predisposed to it. And on and on and on. You know, I don't know why I ended up with bulimia, but I did. You know, and some people, you know, not everybody does. And everyone happens to have the same equipment that I do for, having bulimia. We have stomachs and we have fingers that can purge food back up. And so it's just
and we also have problems and stuff that we're trying not to feel and things that hurt and edges.
There's just a unique, I think, people use all sorts of things. People cut themselves. Yeah. People use tech, people use work, people use sex, people use also like the humans are just wired for addiction. That's it. Yeah. And we do this weird thing where we boil addiction down. Addiction historically meant that you, like, addiction historically meant, like, you could, you know, like, you could be addicted to your, you know, like, Gandhi was addicted to liberation. Like, addicted could be addicted to religion, addicted to God. It wasn't a good or a bad thing. It was just a way to explain total commitment and devotion. And so it's like, but then you strip it down, you strip it down, you strip it down, and you come up with, oh, addiction is alcohol and drugs. And then... and then it moves like into this one area where, you know, and then you're an addict or an alcoholic. And it's just like the way we splinter things off, the way we try and diagnose, the way we try and medicalize, the way we try and like, just like put everything down into the tiny boxes. It's just, it helps no one but people that like labels and like people that like make diagnoses. And
I think like, you know, because we're trained to think of ourselves in terms of being a collection of labels, it is easy for people to go, okay, for some people, I'm this, I'm that.
Yeah, but well, we want to fit in a box.
Extremely restrictive.
Yeah.
I mean, when people ask me about it now, I'm like, the question being, did you have a problem with alcohol? Did you have a drinking problem? I'm like, can you define problem?
Yeah.
Because my experience with alcohol may or may not have been Holly just dropped half a cookie on the floor.
I'm so
why she went
sorry.
Shit.
I was trying to be quiet. No, I've got you your own cookie.
I know you have. And now she's running to the other side of the room, so I'll continue talking for a bit. But yeah, when people ask me, I might define problem because the problems that alcohol was causing me may not be problematic for someone else who was drinking even more than me. And that's the point. And I quote you. I've interviewed you for Sober Curious, and I think my favorite quote from you that I included in the book, you're like, this is really about I'm paraphrasing you, but it's something like, this is really about each of us becoming, having regaining the capacity to like trust in ourselves and our own experience and to live with integrity in our lives,
and to claim our own experience and not let it's not defined by this or that, right? We're not coerced into it. We're deciding for it, right? Based on our own like self agency.
Exactly. So important. Holly, I love the way you talk about this. I'm so excited for your book as well. I think it's just going to be like a
God, forever good fun.
It's going to be really, really, really great. So I'd love to ask you, because I feel like you're super well placed and you have so many years experience and have been an absolute pioneer, if not the pioneer in this space. Some of the questions that I get asked all the time at events and workshops and things, like some of the really, and I'm sure these are many of the questions that people come to you when they're coming for coaching and going through your school as well. The number one thing that people always ask me is like, all my friends drink. What do I do? How do I kind of navigate my social life whilst being a non-drinker?
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear, I mean, you spoke about like, you know, sober social options 5 years ago were none, maybe none. Were a VCR. Like, was this before Netflix?
Becky Sinister.
Like, even before Netflix?
No, it wasn't before Netflix. That's why I was just like, we have to go back to VCRs.
Maybe we should tell him about Netflix.
No, it was just like the saddest article. It was just like, I think for me, it's a great question. And I think for me, I have found that there's a couple things to it. First, I'm an introvert and I never allowed myself to really understand that about myself. Because I measured my worth and like, am I invited to, you know, how many things am I invited to? Like, how much am I liked? How much am I, you know, like this, like idea of like this, like, you know, having to fit in, having to belong, having to be liked. And I think that there was for me this like cut from that where I actually got to examine what I'm going to allow to define me and how I want to spend my time. Mm-hmm. And so I think a couple things need to be said about this. First, this is, you know, somebody asked this the other night on the panel and she was just, I was on a panel and she was afraid that she was going to lose all of her friends. Mm-hmm. And I was like,
that's, I think one of the most common fears.
So lose them.
Yeah.
Like, good. If you are afraid that you not drinking is going to make you lose your friends, then there's a lot more that's going on there than just you not drinking.
If your friendship is dependent on getting fucked together, then perhaps there are more rewarding friendships there for you.
That's right. And also just this idea, those aren't reasons to like make personal choices to keep friends. Friends move with you through personal choices and evolutions. Mm. And sometimes they don't. And like, it's just for us to continuously try and like, we're all on this planet, like we're all whole and one and all that, but we're really also here by ourselves. And like the point of what we are here to do is to, I just read this quote like this morning. It was so good to allow the life that wants to be lived through us to be lived through us, right? Mm. We're here to basically remove all these barriers to really listen to this thing. And if you're sitting there and you're like, I'd like to stop drinking, or I'd like to look at this thing, but I'm afraid of, you know, like X, Y, or Z happening, not being invited to events, not, you know, being able, like feeling awkward, blah, blah, whatever it is.
Well, being
you're
judged.
Not allowing or being judged or all the things that come along with it. You're not really allowing that life to be lived through. You're denying this desire that you have for something more. And I think when we move in this direction, when you move to like really just saying, fuck it, like I am going to do this thing for myself, because that's who you do it for. Never anyone else, always for yourself. You end up like basically testing all of these, all these ways that you're shackled, all these ways that you like haven't really given yourself the opportunity. Do you haven't allowed, like I gave myself the opportunity to test out who I could become. And that was, of course, like the changing of every friendship, every relationship. And it turns out my job, everything changed. And it is terrifying, but it moves mountains. And what you end up doing is you continuously get into the habit of like being able to test what you've settled for. Mm. And so I think,
and to also test like how small is this box that I put
myself
in.
This box
is so teeny tiny.
It's so small. And then
I want it because it's comfortable and it makes me feel held. Yeah. And I'm afraid of what's outside of the box.
That's right. But everything that's outside of the box and all the hell you have to go through is like if whatever you want, whatever you desire is on the other side of that. It's just the way it works. If you're afraid of losing friends, if you're afraid of losing security, if you're afraid of losing status, if you're afraid of losing your brunch, whatever, like of having to have sex sober, of having to date sober, of having to go to wedding sober. These are all real things. Mm-hmm. And like, these are real things that like are very different than the way that you've operated. And it's like, it's not to be understated. It's a big deal to go to a wedding sober.
It's a
really big deal to have sex sober. It's a really big deal to date sober. It's fantastically weird and awkward and crazy and all sorts of stuff. But like, but when you do this, you're like, shit. Like there's this, like when you test these things, you start to move closer to everything that you want. You're no longer holding on to what's safe. You're going for what's more. And that's like, if we could only all do that, you know?
And support each other in that, you
know?
That's
right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Can you tell me any tips you have for sober dating? Because again, people ask me about this all the time. I'm like, dude, I haven't been on a date since 1998.
Oh my God.
There weren't even apps then. There wasn't even the fucking internet then. There weren't apps. Like, I don't know. Plus all the dating I did with my now husband, we were pretty high. So yeah. I don't really have any good advice for that. Any advice you've got for sober dating?
Oh my God, it's so terrible and so fun. Yeah, I think it's just the first sober date I went on was very awkward and short-lived, and I never saw him again. And the next one I went on, I met a man that I dated for a really long time. Mm. And I think it's just like sobriety pushed me to be so comfortable. Like I have to be cool with my awkwardness. I did not get less awkward. I still am. I didn't get less empathic. I still am a bleeding empath. I didn't get less, I don't know, like less myself. I didn't become less myself. I became more myself. Mm. You know, which I would have said years ago, unfortunately, I became more myself. Fortunately, I became more myself. Mm. I became more me. And I think the dating has always been a chance for me to like break more of like these things that hold me, like allow myself to just be myself in public and with another person observing me. It's just allowed me to get more in my skin. Mm. And so I think like when I think back to like Luca was the second person I dated for a long period of time. And when we were dating, it was so empowering to just show up with somebody and he would have a drink and I didn't drink. And I think it was like just, I don't know. It was this like sweet, perfect time in my life where I wasn't getting shit faced on dates to make it through the date. It was all really happening and I was all really there for it and for all of it, for like the, you know, the first kiss, for all of it, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember every bit of the whole thing.
And I think what you said about, you know, I'm showing up as more and more myself in every situation, you're ultimately then going to be attracting more and more of what is right for you.
Well, like, not the necessarily.
The only things that stick. You're not going to wind up in some kind of like weird kind of texting, like semi are we aren't we thing with someone that you. Well, it'll be like either a yes or a no. Or am I getting that wrong?
That sounds so. I mean, sure. I wish. no, I think I.
I mean, I know nothing.
I think that. I mean, I regressed when I like. I had never allowed like the animal that was me to grow up, and I was about a 5 year old. I mean, emotionally speaking, when I got sober, like with when it came to relationships with men, truly, and I'm not exaggerating. And I have had different relationships over the years that were terrible that allowed me to. I mean, no, this is not PC at all, but I dated this guy, Justin, forever. And my friend Danny, and I would never say this today, but I'm just going to say it now. She called him my like psycho vacuum because I would lose it on him. Like he was terrible to me, and we would end up in these situations where I would just like every terrible, hateful, fucked up thing I could possibly say, I would say to this person. And then we would fuck 2 weeks later, you know? And like, it was just like this cycle that continued for years. And I needed that. I had to actually go through that to realize that I didn't deserve that. And I didn't want that. Mm. And my relationships have progressively gotten more and more. As I have become myself and as I set boundaries for myself and standards for myself, it's just so weird. If you were to line up all these guys that I've dated in the last, whatever, six years, they are just so vastly different. And so what I was attracted to at one point is different than what I'm attracted to now. Mm. And but what I'm attracted to now, you couldn't have given to me 5 years ago. I would have run from it. And so I think that it is, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Because I think what you're describing is this period of not just becoming your, it's not just about becoming more yourself. It's about accepting more of yourself, right?
Yeah.
As you become more of yourself, it's then about like, oh, so this is what I really want from a partnership.
And this is what
but
I really am.
Everything that's not nothing I was conditioned to want from a partnership. It doesn't look like this.
Right?
It doesn't look like that. It looks like this. What?
Yeah. No, I think like I also think it's really important to state, like, when people like when we until we really do the work to recover, and it doesn't, I'm not just talking about alcohol addiction. Yeah. I'm talking about all of us, the work that all of us have to do to recover in a world that like turns us outside of ourselves. Everyone has a story of when they left. Mm-hmm. And I think that like for me, and then addiction just doesn't allow you to metabolize your emotions. Like you're just constantly, every time you feel something is the moment that you don't process it or sit with it. You turn to something else. You turn outside of yourself. So if you can think about this, for years, every time I felt some heightened emotion or something I didn't want to feel, that's the moment like where the work begins. That's the moment where you learn to grow and to expand and evolve. And you're just like taking the easy pass and going somewhere else. And so you never get the chance to actually grow up.
And that part just kind of stays.
It just is
stuck here.
Yeah. Yeah.
In this belief, which is like now 15 years old.
Yeah, it's true. It's really true. And I think that was when I started drinking. It was when I was 15. Mm-hmm. And that was not long after my parents divorced, not long after my dad came out. My dad's gay. My dad came out of the closet not long after that. And my family fell apart. And I think it's just, I just stopped. Mm-hmm. I just stopped processing. And
stopped feeling safe. And so,
well, you just check out, right? Yeah. Like you can't, it's too much. You find coping mechanisms. Yeah. That's what addiction is. So I think like, the point of it is saying, like, when I stopped using drugs or alcohol or like anything, like, I mean, men became at a certain point in my recovery part of like just the next like addiction, right? And then, as did coffee, you know? And, and I think it's just taken me time to be able, like, I've had to allow myself the grace to grow into who I am, and I have to continue to do that. I think all of us do. Mm. But yeah, dating is really, I'm so happy for you if you have to date, and I also don't wish it on anybody, you know?
For everybody listening, that's dating is an amazing opportunity for you to learn to love and accept yourself on an increasingly deep level and caretake yourself. And like you said, set up the boundaries. Like,
that's
this
right.
is who I am, and I'm not standing for anything less than what I actually
need. That's
lead.
Right.
And that's
I
it.
Know who the fuck I am now, and
yes.
I know what I'm not going to take, and I'm yes. just done. There was like 2 years ago, I was having sex with my tattoo artist, and like, as one does. And like, we were like, I don't even, like, the whole thing was just awful. And I was just like, no. I like just, it was the first time during bad sex where somebody, where it was always about him. I just literally stopped and I was done. And I just, I was over it. I walked out. I was like, I am not doing this ever again, because I had learned my whole life to just sit there and take it and do it and like, yeah. just look fuckable while you're doing it.
Yeah.
And in that moment, I was just like, oh my God. Like,
no.
Like, and I started laughing because he was doing like that jackrabbit thing. That's just, I just was like, I am never doing this again. And that could have only come at that exact moment in time where I was like, what the fuck? I am not like, I am not your sex toy and I am leaving. And so it's just these, like, it's just like these small little evolutions that you find. And I don't think that's just for people that are dating. I think that's for anybody.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen people do that with jobs. I've seen people do that in
partners.
All different situations. Partners.
Yep.
Exactly. Just like, no.
No.
This is not okay.
No. I'm done. Like, the me a year or two ago was fine with this. But this me I'm growing into is not going
to
do
that. And it's the same. It's like that no to alcohol, no to the way alcohol is preventing me from living my life is the first of actually many no's that are going to come up. It's
that's
like,
right.
no, this isn't good enough.
No,
I'm not accepting that.
That's
and
right.
that
you
can then be expanded out into the wider world too.
That's
like
right.
more of us saying no to what the fuck is not okay is exactly what the world needs,
that's
you know?
Right.
Yes.
And also it's just like that no. It's like not just the no to alcohol, it's also the no to your friends saying, are you sure? Not just one.
Ugh, yeah,
you know?
Totally.
You have to like withstand that.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot. And
yeah.
when you keep on saying, no, I'm not drinking, you know, that is like,
and if, yeah.
for some of us, the first times that we've asserted our agency and what
yeah.
we're going to like do and not do. And,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
yeah.
It's huge, actually.
It is.
It's huge. Something else that comes up a lot is, okay, I'm really down with this. It feels great. But then there comes a point when I just want to switch off from being on mode to switch into relax and off mode. And nothing does that for me like a glass of wine. And this particularly comes up. And again, I don't have kids, so I can't really speak. And it comes up from moms particularly.
Yeah.
I want to switch off quickly. I have an hour for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I want that hour to... I just want to like switch everything off, you know? What's
yeah.
your kind of quick fix? Is there even a quick fix? Is that just, again, something that we had to kind of work with or throw
yeah.
out?
Yeah. I think in Tempest Sobriety School, we spend an entire week working. Like the first 3 weeks are like really meant to develop like the ability to create new rituals and new ways of being so that you go naturally to other things so that you, first of all, don't get so ramped up, but also so at the end of the day, usually 5 o'clock when we're like popping off, we have different ways to bring ourselves down.
Mm.
For me, it is making my home a haven. It is, I don't do things most nights of the week. And so I don't overschedule myself. So I am not like, I know if I have 3 events, 3 nights in a row, that I am going to lose my shit and like be crawling out of my skin. And so it's about scheduling space. And then when I come home, it's typically I use lavender essential oil. That's like my number one drug of choice.
Mm-hmm.
I take hot baths. I do breath exercises, like Breath of Fire is one of my go-tos. And also this breath called Sitali breathing. These are both Kundalini breath exercises. Those
which
are things
you can probably Google.
Sitali is Sitali.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking of this meme that, never mind. then you can, what else is there? I mean, I think it's about not so much, I think it's about not winding it up so much that it pops,
yeah,
right? I think that's like part of it, which is just minding our energy and managing our energy.
It's actually rather than treating the symptom,
yeah,
which is the stress, which is the fuck, I'm so wound up, I just need to stop. It's like not getting to that place in the first place.
And it's also sitting with it. We were talking earlier about sitting with the edges of your energy, like relaxing into the edge of your, like the edges of your energy. It's a Pema Chodron quote. And it's just like, When I'm ragey, I mean, my Steph Snyder, who you know, she's mm-hmm. my yoga teacher. She's who I did my training with, and she's sober and magical. And she has said before that her baseline is agitated. And like, she's just fire. And, mine is too. Like, my baseline is not chill. I am not a chill person. And
I'll get my hand up here.
You mean you're not, or you know, I'm not?
No, I know I'm not.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Like, right. I'm not like, it's,
although it's weird, the more that I detach from everybody else's expectations of me, yeah. the more chill I find I yeah. am, which yeah. is fucking great.
Well, because you can be chill, like you, but like, yeah, I think there's also me. This, like, there is this, like, my baseline is again, like, that agitated is the best word I can think of to describe myself. And I have to work from that baseline. And sometimes that means that I have to be uncomfortable. Sometimes I just, like, I remember going through the airport, PMSing on no sleep, like maybe 3 or 4 months ago. And like, the airports for me are like the place where I remember to practice kindness. Like, and also where it's the hardest to practice kindness. And I'm like going through and I'm just like about to have a nuclear fucking meltdown in the middle of the airport. Like, you know, when you're just so close that you can just like yeah. almost like you can see yourself like screaming in a pile on the floor in the middle of like JFK. And like, I was in that place and I remember the Pema quote. And I was like, relax into the edges of, like, relax into this. Like, you can actually feel that deep, painful edge of your energy, that, like, that velocity of it and that tightness and all that heat and all of it. And you can actually, as a, like, Buddhist practice, as a meditative practice, as a mindfulness practice, just, okay, I notice that right now I'm uncomfortable. My body is tight. I feel like I am about to explode. And it's just like, to me, it's not changing it, right? Because changing it is just another escape, yeah. right? It is actually allowing it and yeah. not resisting it. Because then you start resisting it, you want to change it. You know, I think it's so important to do these practices to bring it down and to manage ourselves, to make ourselves feel more peaceful. And there's also the practice of allowance, which is so important, because if we don't allow, it's just the next thing and the next thing. We're never really with ourselves, right?
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, I was sharing before we came on that I, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I went through a period of extreme intense anxiety like I hadn't felt for a long time. Mm-hmm. And in the moment, and it was the first time I found myself craving alcohol in yeah. like so long, like yeah. as long as I can remember. And I was yeah. like, that's very interesting. I never even used to want alcohol when I was anxious, but I just was like, there's literally the monkey mind. It's not, it won't shut up. And it's taking me here and now it's taking me here. And it was just
yeah.
literally, I described my state of mind to my husband. I was like, my brain feels like scrambled egg that's being shot through with lightning bolts.
Yeah.
I was like, this is not comfortable. And it lasted for about 2 weeks. But coming yeah. out of it, mm-hmm. because now I have learned, as yoga, the practice of yoga is practically designed to teach us, sit with this
yeah.
and it will pass.
That's right.
I have learned that.
That's right.
I just sat in it. I right. didn't run from it.
Right.
And coming out of it, I realized that so many of those quote unquote crazy thoughts, don't necessarily love that word, but so many of those kind of erratic, painful, uncomfortable thoughts had actually brought deep realizations to me about what I needed to get rid of out of my life. And I was so grateful coming out the other side of it to be able to look at, oh yeah, shit, I was feeling really anxious about all this stuff. Do I have to keep doing this stuff?
Yeah.
I actually get a really zoomed out perspective on like, what would happen if I actually just made some changes here? Some changes which might seem like insane, you know?
Yeah,
like,
I know.
But changes that I can't, that, well, it is within my power to make. Oh my right? God, we're going to get to the Serenity Prayer in a second.
Are we?
No, we're not.
I love the Serenity Prayer.
The Serenity Prayer is awesome. I actually looked up who wrote it the other day. I can't remember who wrote it. I can't remember, but
I was thinking of the Prayer of St. Francis recently. I want to start. I used to repeat that every day.
What is it?
Oh God, it is where there is, it's like the one where there's not, like, let me bring it. Like, so I can't think of it. I'm not going to be able to say
okay,
right now.
We'll
but I also want to just talk about what you were just saying, which is, I think that's so important to understand. Again, it's like the staying, right? Like, we learn to stay. Like, you, yeah. you know, in your book, you say you talk about Tommy Rosen and, you know, how he talks about the opposite of addiction. Everyone has an opposite of fucking addiction.
meditation is the opposite of addiction.
Right. And meditation is awareness. And so it's like this, like, awareness is the opposite of numb. Like, the trade-off is we have to stay with ourselves through, like, really uncomfortable things like that. And I think, you know, I went through a year this last year when I moved to New York. I haven't, like, I until like maybe 2 months ago I didn't sleep. And then I lost my hearing for a period. Like, it's just been kind of like one thing after the other. But like, I think at any other point in time in my life I had to just stay. And like the insomnia I had for the last year and the anxiety I had for the last year were more than I think I even had when I was drinking. Maybe not, that's not true. But like, very, you know, it's just, we go through stuff, you know, and I think it just, like, it requires, to me it was just like an opportunity to bring more consistency into my life and also, like, take care of myself more.
Yeah. Well, that was going to be my final question, the anxiety thing. Well, actually, no, my final question, and let's end on this because I know you have to get onto a meeting and you've already shared so much goodness. But another question that came up at an event I did last week, and she was like, so I've been, like, sober since December, or I've not drinking since December. It feels amazing, and I find myself wanting to share it with everyone, and I'm so excited about it, and I can see everyone around me just being a bit like, will you fucking shut up about this sobriety thing now? And she's like, you know, because in my book I talk about the evangelical phase, and then I always kind of laugh because I'm like telling people to be wary of that, and I'm like, I wrote a fucking book on this, so
yeah,
which is my way of evangelizing about it. But also it's that thing about, like, how to navigate being so stoked about this secret you seem to have, like, uncovered, and not piss off everyone around you who maybe isn't quite
there,
getting it yet, or there yet.
I think I have a couple answers to that. First is, there, like, a couple weeks ago when I was with Steph Snyder, we were doing a workshop and we were talking about the first part of like almost like a spiritual awakening or a spiritual path or whatever you want to call it, and it's like the evangelical stage. It's the part where everything is, it's like the pink cloud. It's And this is, like, across so many different experiences, but to me, this is very true for when I got sober and, like, when I first started waking up to, oh, my God, I believe in God. Oh, my God, I want to know about Jesus. I want to be in meditation for 20 hours a day. I want to know everything, and, like, isn't the world beautiful? And so I think that I think that period of enthusiasm is so precious, and it's so short-lived.
So just enjoy it?
Yeah, I'm just like, go for it. Do it. Like, yes. Because then the period after that Steph was talking about is the desert. And it's when you forget why you even cared in the first place. And then that's where, like, when we were talking, like, in this training, we were just talking about, that's when your faith comes on board. That's when that's when the breadth increases. That's when you go deeper and wider and it gets fuller. And it's no longer something you're excited about. It's something you don't even want to do, and something that you have to really, truly, like, pull from the bottom of your feet up to, like, grab onto. And so I think one, like, good on her. And I think, like, if people are turned off by how excited you are for this choice that you've made, that's not your problem. That's their problem. I think that the other, like, guardrails are, you know, like, telling other people what they should do. Yeah. Like, one of the things that I found was really interesting, I was on, you know, Melissa Hartwig. Do you know who she is? No. Whole 30.
Oh, right,
I was on her podcast recently, and, like, she was, she stopped drinking, and she's just checking it out, and, like, doing it. She recovered from drug addiction, but she'd kept drinking for years. And, like, 19 years. Wow. She's been sober, and she wouldn't call herself sober, but sober from drugs. And anyway, the point is, she posted this about, you know, what about, she posted our podcast, and then it was just really interesting to see the comments because people were very defensive. People just thought because she was talking about not drinking, it meant they should stop drinking. And people have a very, very, very defensive relationship around alcohol, again, because of everything we've been talking about, because you're either an alcoholic or you're not, you know? And like, if you, and like, you don't want, you like, we don't want to like infringe on the people who can keep drinking, you know, party. And there's like so much stuff that goes into this. And I think it's just the natural piece of this is that people are going to be super defensive about like even if you're being the most careful evangelist, they're still going to feel like you are personally attacking them and their decision to drink. So I think the guardrails on it are always just allowing, like, I think that my guardrail is always not dismissing, you do you. I don't want to have to say, because I talk about wonderful sobriety is, I don't want to have to caveat it every single time to make sure that people don't feel offended by the fact that I don't drink and I think not drinking is wonderful. I think like everything I do in my message and how I talk about this is not meant to bring shame to anybody. Everyone has a place, like we were talking about at the beginning. I used to drink. I don't like hate drinkers or think they're assholes or idiots. Like I had to drink to not drink. And I think that like we... Well, okay, I'm trying to wind this up. What I'm basically saying is you, for all of us, like the whole thing is tolerance. The whole thing is coming from a place of being able to share your light, share your truth, and let other people be where they're at. And also to love everyone where they're at and to help like eradicate this idea of shame around, well, now I'm sober, so now I'm pure, now I'm clean. And, you know, that's just not the truth. You don't just go from adolescent to like pearly, like perfectly formed, you know, adult that knows everything. And, you know, you make the mistakes or you take, you know, go through the life experiences, and we have to respect where everybody is at, even if it doesn't look like what we think it should look like. It's just allowing everyone to be where they're at in their own life. So yes. Is that covered? Or is that like so far off?
I feel like I should say yes. Thank you. Good night. Amen.
Because that is
ultimately it. Holly, thank you so much for coming and sharing all of your wisdom with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So excited for your book.
Oh, God, me too.
Amazing. And I'm really excited for people to discover more about Tempest as well. And,
yeah,
and
you can go
join
to,
you on this
can
journey.
Can I tell them where to go
of
to
course
sign
you
up?
Can tell them where they go.
Okay, our next school... When does this go up?
Soon, like
okay.
This week.
Cool. Our next school is July 18th, and we run an 8-week program that helps people explore their relationship with alcohol and also recover from addiction. And then we also have an aftercare program that is annual membership, and the, you know, the basic tentpoles of it are community, content, and care. So it's a place that you go on the internet to find people that are going through what you're going through, to learn how to not drink, and also be supported in that journey. Jointempest.com. Thank you, honey, for having me. This is so good.
Well, I told you Holly knew her stuff. I have a feeling this might be an episode you want to go back and listen to again to dive deeper into some of the big topics that were raised and that Holly and I got into. I think I will be for sure. And if you are sober curious, but finding it more difficult than you anticipated to maintain extended periods of abstinence and really answer your sober curious questions for yourself, then most definitely check out Tempest and consider signing up for one of Holly's online courses where you can get additional support from a very holistic place to look at your own relationship with substances and really come back into a place of true integrity with always making the choices that are right for you. Thank you again for being here. I'm so thrilled to be sharing these conversations with you. More from me soon. This podcast features original music and is edited by alloaudio.com, www.aloeaudio.com.